and escalating fears at home. With Johnson out of the 1968 race, Republican Richard Nixon narrowly defeated Johnson's vice president, Hubert Humphrey, and Alabama Governor George Wallace, an ardent segregationist who ran as an independent. Nixon and his top foreign affairs advisor, Henry Kissinger, tried several tactics to extricate the United States from the war without just turning over South Vietnam to the communists. One tactic was to coerce the South Vietnamese government into taking more responsibility for the war. To force the issue, the United States began withdrawing some troops in 1969. At the same time, however, Nixon ordered an increase in the bombing of North Vietnam, as well as in the neighboring countries of Laos and Cambodia. In essence, he was trying to put pressure on both sides to stop the fighting. In 1970, Nixon approved the invasion of Cambodia by U.S. troops who were pursuing North Vietnamese soldiers based there. The decision intensified opposition to the war, and massive anti-war demonstrations spread across the country. At Kent State University in Ohio, National Guard troops shot and killed 4 student demonstrators. Technical stuff. Vietnam by the numbers. The following numbers tell a story of their own. Number of Americans killed, 58,174. Number wounded, 304,000. Cost, 1950 through 1974, $150 billion. Peak number of U.S. troops stationed in Vietnam, 535,000. Average age of U.S. soldier killed, 23. Age of youngest U.S. soldier killed, 16. Age of oldest U.S. soldier killed, 62. Average number of days in combat by U.S. infantry soldier in 1 year in Vietnam, 240. Anti-war fever grew even stronger in 1971 when the New York Times published what became known as the Pentagon Papers. The documents, leaked by a former Defense Department worker named Daniel Ellsberg, proved the government had lied about the war's conduct. Later that year, an Army lieutenant named William Calley was convicted of supervising the massacre of more than 100 unarmed civilians at a village called My Lai. Remember, but despite mounting opposition to the war, Nixon easily won re-election in 1972, in part because of a politically inept opponent, U.S. Senator George McGovern of South Dakota, and in part because Kissinger announced a few weeks before the election that a peace settlement was not too far off. After the election, however, Nixon ordered heavy bombing of North Vietnam's capital, of Hanoi. The bombing failed to break North Vietnamese resolve, and 15 U.S. bombers were shot down. On January 27, 1973, the United States and North Vietnam announced they had reached an agreement to end the fighting and would work to negotiate a settlement. The peace treaty proved to be a face-saving sham, allowing U.S. troops to be withdrawn before the communists closed in. In April 1975, North Vietnamese troops overran South Vietnam and took over the entire country. America had suffered its first decisive defeat in a war, touching off a reassessment of its role in the world and on how it would approach involvement in conflicts in the future. Continuing the fight for civil rights. Although the civil rights movement began in the 1950s, it reached full steam in the 1960s, marked by several new tactics that proved effective in breaking down discrimination. Enforcing their rights, African Americans. In February 1960, 4 African American students sat down at a segregated lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina, and refused to leave after they were denied service. The sit-in became a strategy used across the country, and by the end of 1961, some 70,000 people had taken part in sit-ins. In May 1961, black and white activists began freedom rides traveling in small groups to the South to test local segregation laws. The inspirational leader of the movement was the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr., a courageous and eloquent orator who founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and won the 1964 Nobel Peace Prize for his civil rights work. But not all African Americans were enamored of King's nonviolent demonstration approach. They also didn't believe equality could be attained through cooperation among the races. Leaders, such as the black Muslims Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X, warned African Americans to neither expect nor seek help from whites. "If someone puts a hand on you," said Malcolm X, "send him to the cemetery." Looking for legal remedies to discrimination. Both approaches eventually put pressure on the federal government to act. President Kennedy and his brother Robert, who was also his attorney general, used federal troops and marshals to force the admission of black students to the state universities in Alabama and Mississippi. In June 1963, JFK proposed a bill that would ban racial discrimination in hotels, restaurants, and other public places, and give the federal government more authority to clamp down on state and local agencies that drag their feet in enforcing civil rights laws. Black organizers gathered 200,000 demonstrators for a march in Washington, D.C., to support the Kennedy proposal. Remember, after Kennedy's assassination, the cause was taken up by Johnson. Despite his Southern roots, LBJ was a committed liberal whose Great Society programs mirrored the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s. In addition to providing more federal aid to America's down-and-outs, an effort known as the War on Poverty, LBJ pushed the 1964 Civil Rights Act through Congress. It featured many of the same elements Kennedy had proposed. Johnson followed it with another bill in 1965 that strengthened federal safeguards for black voters' rights. But events and emotions moved faster than politics. In early 1965, Malcolm X, who had softened his earlier opposition to interracial cooperation, was murdered by black Muslim extremists who considered such talk traitorous. A few months later, a march led by Martin Luther King, Jr. from Selma to Montgomery in Alabama was viciously attacked by state and local police, while a horrified national television audience watched. Tired of waiting for an equal chance at the U.S. economic pie, many African Americans began demanding affirmative action programs in which employers would actively recruit minorities for jobs. Black power became a rallying cry for thousands of young African Americans. Taking it to the streets. The anger manifested itself in a rash of race riots in the mid and late 1960s. The first was in August 1965 in the Los Angeles community of Watts. Before it was over, 6 days of rioting had led to 34 deaths, 850 injuries, 3,000 arrests, and more than $200 million in damages. Riots followed in the next 2 years in dozens of cities, including New York, Chicago, Newark, and Detroit, where 43 people were killed in July 1967. Then things got worse. On April 4, 1968, Martin Luther King, Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. A white man named James Earl Ray was eventually arrested and convicted of the crime. More riots followed across the country, most notably in Washington, D.C. The riots, in turn, triggered a backlash by many whites. George Wallace, a racist and ardent segregationist, got 13.5% of the vote in the 1968 presidential election, and much of the steam of the civil rights movement had dissipated by the time Richard Nixon moved into the White House. Big dreams. "I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Martin Luther King, Jr., August 28, 1963, before the Lincoln Memorial, Washington, D.C. Challenging the System, Latin Americans. African Americans weren't the only minority group on the move in the 1960s. Americans of Latin American descent had been treated as second-class citizens since the 1840s. While their numbers increased during and after World War II, mainly because thousands of Mexicans came to the country as a source of cheap labor, Latinos were largely ghettoized in inner-city barrios and rural areas of the Southwest. They were generally invisible in terms of the political process. Between 1960 and 1970, however, the number of Latinos in the United States tripled, from 3 million to 9 million, with perhaps another 5 million living in the country illegally. Cubans came to Florida, Puerto Ricans to New York, and Mexicans to California. With the increase in numbers came an increased interest in better political, social, and economic treatment for La Raza, the race. Leaders, particularly among Mexican-Americans or Chicanos, sprang up. Reyes López Tejerina in New Mexico, Rodolfo Corky Gonzalez in Colorado, and Cesar Chavez in California. Latinos began to pursue organized efforts to gain access to the educational and economic systems and fight racial stereotypes. Latin Americans were elected to municipal and state offices and gradually began to organize themselves into a formidable political force in some parts of the country. Cesar Chavez. His opponents accused him of sour grapes, but to Cesar Chavez, it was merely a question of tactics. Chavez was born in 1927 on a small family farm near Yuma, Arizona. During the Depression, his family lost the farm and was forced to move, becoming laborers on other people's farms in California and the Southwest. After serving in the Navy during World War II, Chavez settled in San Jose, California, and became an official in a Latino community service organization. In 1962, using his life savings, he founded the United Farm Workers, UFW, a union for a group that no other union was interested in. Chavez was an advocate of nonviolence, and he believed the union's interests should extend beyond labor contracts to other areas of social justice for farm workers. By the mid-1960s, Chavez and the UFW had begun to organize farm workers in earnest. When strikes failed to work, he began boycotting products, particularly grapes. The aim of the boycotts was to get consumers not to buy the product until a fair labor agreement was in place. By the end of the 1970s, the UFW's membership was more than 70,000. The state of California had created a state board to mediate disputes between growers and workers, and for the first time, the nation's most downtrodden workers had union contracts. Chavez died in 1993. The following year, his work not only as a union leader, but also as a civil rights leader and humanitarian, was recognized when he was posthumously awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. Maintaining their culture, Native Americans. No minority group had been treated worse than Native Americans, nor had any group been less able to do anything about it. They had lower average incomes, higher rates of alcoholism, and shorter life expectancies than any other ethnic group. And because their numbers were few, the federal government, since the turn of the century, had largely ignored them. In the 1950s, federal policies tried to push Native Americans to abandon their traditional ways. In the 1960s, some Native Americans began to push back. In 1961, the National Indian Youth Council was established, followed by the American Indian Movement in 1968. The efforts of these and other groups helped lead the Indian Civil Rights Act in 1968, which granted U.S. rights to Native Americans living on reservations while allowing them to set their own laws according to tribal customs. It would be nice to say that all the racial wrongs in America were made right by the tumultuous events of the 1960s. It would also be absurd. But it isn't absurd to say the period was an overall success in terms of civil rights. It established key new laws, instilled a sense of self-pride in minority groups, and served notice that the issue would not be swept under the rug. "Lord, we ain't what we ought to be," observed Martin Luther King Jr. "We ain't what we want to be. We ain't what we gonna be, but thank God we ain't what we were." Entering a Generation in Revolt. Not all the groups fighting the status quo were tied to each other by race or national origin. The war in Vietnam and the blooming civil rights movement triggered political activism among many young Americans, particularly on college campuses. Groups like Students for a Democratic Society appeared, and activities like draft card burnings became as common as pep rallies. Draft dodging, drugs, and demonstrations. Because of the opposition to the war, thousands of draft-age males fled to Canada and other countries rather than serve in the military. Their actions baffled many of their parents, whose generations had served in World War II and Korea, and widened the gap of misunderstanding between the age groups. The gap was also evident in the younger generation's freer attitudes toward sex, public profanity, and hairstyles. More troubling and longer-lasting in terms of its impact was the use of drugs by the counterculture. The use of marijuana and hallucinogenics like LSD became commonplace. Most of it could be attributed to the excesses of youth. But it was also a disturbing preview of the plagues of drug use that would sweep over the country during the rest of the century. Perhaps nowhere was the generation gap more visible than at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. While mostly middle-aged and middle-class delegates debated an anti-war plank for the party platform, hundreds of mostly young and poor demonstrators battled with club-swinging police in the streets outside the convention center. "The whole world is watching," the demonstrators taunted. Ironically, many of those watching were so troubled by the sight of young people defying authority that they voted for Richard Nixon in 1968 and again in 1972. Nixon appealed to these voters, whom he called the silent majority, because he spoke out strongly against the demonstrations. The rise of feminism. Draft cards weren't the only things being burned during the period. Women, who resented their secondary roles in the workplace, the home, and the halls of government, periodically protested by burning their bras. Women faced barriers in getting jobs in the first place, and when they did find work, they were paid far less than men doing the same tasks. In 1970, women earned 60 cents for every dollar paid a man. Married women were denied credit in their own names, even when they had jobs of their own. Remember, the Women's Liberation Movement gave birth to the National Organization of Women, NOW, in 1966, and by 1970, NOW was organizing women's rights demonstrations and winning court battles over equal pay for equal work. In 1972, Congress approved a constitutional provision called the Equal Rights Amendment and sent it to the states for ratification. But a coalition of conservative and religious groups combined to fight the ERA, and in 1982 it was dead, three states short of the 38 needed for ratification. As it turned out, the amendment hardly mattered, because many of the rights it would have provided were awarded in court decisions. One key decision came in 1973, when in Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court essentially legalized abortion in the first 3 months of pregnancy. The ruling meant women now had a wider range of legal choices when faced with pregnancy. It also meant the beginning of an intense political, legal, social, and religious battle over abortion that continues today. Coming out of the closet. The subject of homosexuality was so unspoken in America for most of its history that many Americans at the beginning of the 20th century had never heard of it or didn't believe it was real. Even into the 1960s, many psychiatrists believed homosexuality was a mental illness, and same-gender sex between consenting adults was still a crime in many states. That began to change in the late 1960s, however, as gay men and women began to assert themselves. In June 1969, New York City police busted a gay nightclub called the Stonewall and began arresting patrons. The bust sparked a riot in the predominantly gay and lesbian community of Greenwich Village. Gay activist organizations like the Gay Liberation Front were started. But changing anti-gay laws and homophobic attitudes was still a work in progress in the first two decades of the 21st century. Harvey Milk. When the first openly gay elected official of any big U.S. city stepped in it, he really stepped in it. As a San Francisco supervisor, Harvey Milk once pushed for a city ordinance to force dog owners to clean up after their pets in public areas. Accompanied by reporters, he staged a stroll through a city park that ended with his foot in a pile of dog droppings for the benefit of the cameras. The measure was approved. Milk was born in 1930 in New York. He served in the Navy during the Korean War as a deep-sea diver, but was dishonorably discharged after his homosexuality was revealed. After a career as a Wall Street stockbroker, Milk moved to San Francisco's predominantly gay Castro Street district, opened a camera store, and began running for office as an openly gay candidate. He was finally elected on his fourth try in 1977. In 1978, Milk and San Francisco Mayor George Moscone were shot to death at City Hall by a disgruntled former city official named Dan White. White received only a 5-year sentence for the killings, triggering gay riots. But Milk's death also inspired many gay professionals to come out of the closet and encouraged other gays to run for office. "If a bullet should enter my brain," Milk had said in a tape-recorded will, "let that bullet destroy every closet door." Weirdness in the White House. Vietnam and a whole bunch of unhappy people in the streets of America weren't the only problems Richard Nixon faced when he took over as president in early 1969. Inflation was running wild. Much of the problem was a result of President Johnson's economic policy of guns and butter, paying for the war and expanding social programs at the same time. Making strides, the Nixon administration. Nixon responded to the situation by cutting government spending and balancing the federal budget for 1969. He also rather reluctantly imposed wage and price freezes on the country. But he wasn't reluctant at all about dropping federal efforts to enforce school integration laws. He had been elected with Southern support and was mindful that polls showed most Americans opposed forcing kids to take buses to schools in other neighborhoods to achieve racial balance. Outside of Vietnam, Nixon enjoyed success in foreign policy. He went to China in early 1972, ending 20 years of diplomatic silence between the two countries, and he pursued a policy of détente, a French term meaning relaxing of tensions, with the Soviet Union. These accomplishments, coupled with vague hints of looming peace in Vietnam and a backlash among voters Nixon called the silent majority against all the protesting, helped Nixon easily win re-election in 1972. In early 1973, the peace settlement with North Vietnam was announced. And despite Democratic majorities in Congress, Nixon was able to veto bills that challenged his authority in a number of areas. He took advantage of it to greatly expand the White House's power and cloak its actions from public scrutiny. And then, an ex-FBI agent named James McCord wrote a letter to a judge, and the wheels of the Nixon White House began to come off. Watching it all fall apart, Watergate. In a nutshell, here's what happened in the greatest presidential scandal in U.S. history, or second greatest. See Chapter 20. On June 17, 1972, McCord and four other men working for the Committee to Re-elect the President, or CREEP, really, broke into the Democratic Party's headquarters in the Watergate, a hotel office building in Washington, D.C. They got caught going through files and trying to plant listening devices. 5 days later, Nixon denied any knowledge of it or that his administration played any role in it. The burglars went to trial in 1973 and either pleaded guilty or were convicted. Before sentencing, McCord wrote a letter to Judge John Sirica, contending that high Republican and White House officials knew about the break-in and had paid the defendants to keep quiet or lie during the trial. Investigation of McCord's charges spread to a special Senate committee. John Dean, a White House lawyer, told the committee McCord was telling the truth and that Nixon had known of the effort to cover up White House involvement. Eventually, all sorts of damaging stuff began to surface, including evidence that key documents linking Nixon to the cover-up of the break-in had been destroyed, that the Nixon Re-election Committee had run a dirty tricks campaign against the Democrats, and that the administration had illegally wiretapped the phones of enemies, such as journalists who had been critical of Nixon. In March 1974, former Attorney General John Mitchell and six top Nixon aides were indicted by a federal grand jury for trying to block the investigation. They were eventually convicted. While Nixon continued to deny any involvement, it was revealed he routinely made secret tapes of conversations in his office. Nixon refused to turn over the tapes at first, and when he did agree, after firing a special prosecutor he had appointed to look into the mess and seeing his new attorney general resign in protest, it turned out some of them were missing or had been destroyed. They were also full of profanity, which greatly surprised people who had a much different perception of Nixon. In the summer of 1974, the House Judiciary Committee approved articles of impeachment against the president for obstructing justice. The tapes clearly showed Nixon had been part of the cover-up. On August 8, 1974, he submitted a one-sentence letter of resignation and then went on television and said, "I have always tried to do what is best for the nation." He was the first U.S. president to quit the job. The Watergate scandal rocked the nation, which was already reeling from the Vietnam disaster, economic troubles, assassinations, and all the social unrest of the preceding 15 years. It fell to Nixon's successor, Vice President Gerald R. Ford, to try to bring back a sense of order and stability to the nation, and no one had voted for him to do it. Small steps and great leaps. It started with a challenge from John F. Kennedy and ended with perhaps the greatest technological feat in human history, man on the moon. On May 25, 1961, Kennedy asked Congress for money to put a U.S. astronaut on the moon before the end of the decade. Congress agreed, and more than $1 billion was spent to get to the afternoon of July 20, 1969. At 1:17 p.m., Pacific Daylight Time, a craft carrying two men landed on the lunar surface. A few hours later, astronaut Neil A. Armstrong stepped out. "That's one small step for man," he said, "one giant leap for mankind. Armstrong was joined on the surface by Buzz Aldrin, while a third astronaut, Michael Collins, circled above in the mothership, Columbia. A worldwide television audience estimated at 1 billion people watched from 250,000 miles away. Some lunar visit facts. Armstrong and Aldrin spent 21 hours on the surface, but only 2 hours, 15 minutes actually walking around and never ventured farther than 275 yards from their craft. They collected 46 pounds of rocks, and they left behind a plaque attached to the base of the landing craft. They got back to the Columbia and the top half of the two-stage lander. The plaque reads, "Here men from the planet Earth first set foot upon the moon, July 1969 A.D. We came in peace for all mankind." Chapter 19. Hold the Malays, or Ayatollah So, 1975 to 1992. In this chapter, wading through Watergate, fueling a failing economy, smiling for the camera and the country, thawing after the Cold War. Nothing puts a damper on a country's attitude like an unscrupulous president, followed by a couple of well-meaning but relatively inept ones, and that's just what occurred in the 1970s. Throw in an oil crisis, a very unsettled economy, and a hostage situation in Iran, and we're not exactly talking about the golden age of America here. In this era, a charismatic figure from, of all places, Hollywood, rides to the rescue, smiles a lot, and generally makes America feel better about itself by the end of the 1980s. Wearing Nixon's shoes. No one voted for Vice President Gerald R. Ford when he became President of the United States on August 8, 1974. Come to think of it, no one had voted for him when he became Vice President either. Remember, Ford had been elected to Congress from Michigan in 1948 and re-elected every 2 years through 1972. In 1973, President Nixon appointed Ford Vice President after the incumbent Vice President, Spiro T. Agnew, resigned. Agnew was a blustering eccentric who proved to be a crook. Finding himself under investigation for extorting bribes from contractors while he was governor of Maryland, Agnew pleaded no contest to a charge of tax fraud, quit the vice presidency, and faded into richly deserved obscurity. A month after becoming president, when Nixon resigned in the wake of the Watergate scandal, Ford decided the country needed to put Watergate behind it. The best way to do that, Ford determined, was to pardon Nixon for any crimes he may have committed while in office. He also vehemently denied making any deal with Nixon before Nixon resigned. About 40 of Nixon's assistants weren't as lucky as their former boss and were indicted for various offenses. Some of them, including Nixon's Attorney General, John Mitchell, and Nixon's top aides, John Ehrlichman and Bob Haldeman, went to prison. Doing the best he could. As an honest, hard-working, and amiable man, Ford did his best as president. Unfortunately, his best wasn't great. Although he had been a college football star and a leader in Congress, he was stuck by the media with an undeserved image as a not-too-coordinated, not-too-bright guy. Falling down a flight of airplane stairs, hitting a spectator with a ball during a golf tournament, and occasionally misspeaking didn't help. Lyndon Johnson joked that Ford had played one too many games without his helmet. Ford's pardon of Nixon angered many Americans who felt the former president shouldn't have escaped facing the justice system. But even without the Watergate hangover, 1975 wasn't a great time to be president, for Ford or anyone. In late April 1975, the communists completed their takeover in Vietnam. American diplomats, scrambled onto escape helicopters from the roofs of buildings near the U.S. Embassy in Saigon, with the whole world watching from living room TVs. Most of the rest of Indochina had already fallen under communist control or fell soon after. Not on my shift. I did not take the sacred oath of office to preside over the decline and fall of the United States of America. Gerald R. Ford, after assuming the presidency, August 1974. Whipping inflation. Even worse for Ford than the humiliation of the fall of Saigon, the U.S. economy was a mess. Inflation was soaring, and the unemployment rate reached 9%, the highest level since 1941. Ford's response included asking Americans to wear buttons that bore the acronym WIN, for Whip Inflation Now. The buttons didn't have much of an impact, however. Despite the buttons' ineffectiveness, Ford refused to take stronger measures. He neglected to address such issues as wage and price controls and did little to lessen the country's growing dependence on foreign oil. So when oil-producing nations, mainly in the Middle East, dramatically jacked up oil prices, 400% in 1974 alone, the United States suffered a price increase on just about every other product as well. The Nixon pardon, the humiliating end to Vietnam, and the staggering economy proved to be three strikes against Ford. After barely winning the Republican nomination over former California Governor Ronald Reagan, Ford lost the 1976 presidential election to Jimmy Carter, the former governor of Georgia. The way things turned out, Ford may have been the lucky one. Good intentions, bad results. America turned 200 in 1976, and for its bicentennial birthday, it gave itself a new president. His name was James Earl Carter, but everyone called him Jimmy. He was a Naval Academy graduate, a nuclear engineer, a peanut farmer, and the former governor of Georgia. He ran for the presidency as a Washington outsider. Because U.S. voters were pretty sick of Washington insiders, they elected him in a close race over the incumbent, Gerry Ford. Carter was the first candidate since 1932 to defeat an incumbent president. He was also the first president from the Deep South since the Civil War. Ford had started his administration with the controversial pardoning of Richard Nixon, and Carter started his with the controversial pardoning of Vietnam War draft evaders. The two men had other similarities. Both seemed to have a tough time being consistent in their policy and decision-making, and both had real troubles with the economy because of runaway inflation and oil shortages. Measuring misery. During the 1976 campaign, Carter added up the nation's unemployment rate and inflation level, called it a misery index, and used it as an effective rhetorical weapon against Ford. Unfortunately for Carter, by the time he left office, the level of misery was higher than when he took over. The annual inflation rate, the change in the price of various consumer goods, went from 5% in 1970 to 14.5% in 1980. The price of gasoline went from about 40 cents a gallon to more than 70 cents. Part of the reason for both higher inflation and high oil prices was America's increasing dependence on foreign oil. Simply put, the country was using far more oil, for everything from running cars to making textiles, than it was producing. Remember, in the early 1970s, Arab oil-producing countries cut off supplies to the United States and other Western nations as a way of pressuring Israel to give back Arab territory it had taken during a 1967 war. When the embargo was lifted in 1974, the Western countries' oil reserves had dried up, and the oil-producing countries could pretty much charge whatever they wanted for their product. Higher oil prices helped fuel inflation, and inflation helped trigger higher interest rates. companies couldn't afford to borrow money to expand, so unemployment rose. Carter tried various ways to combat the problems, including voluntary wage and price controls, but they didn't help much. Things got so bad that Carter went on national TV to acknowledge that a crisis of confidence had struck the nation. The address became known as the Malaise Speech, and to many people, it made Carter appear to be a self-pitying crybaby. A nuclear oops. One of the great hopes of weaning America from its dependence on foreign oil was nuclear power from plants like the one on the banks of the Susquehanna River in a bucolic area of Pennsylvania called Three Mile Island. On March 28, 1979, one of the plant's thousands of valves went on the fritz. The malfunction caused temperatures in the plant's reactor chamber to climb to 5,000 degrees, melting the lining of the reactor chamber before being stopped by the thick concrete floor. Pregnant women and children were evacuated, and as many as 60,000 other people voluntarily fled the area. As it turned out, only relatively low levels of radiation escaped, and no claims of personal or property damage were ever proven. But the accident effectively exploded the hopes of expanding nuclear power as an energy source in America. Although 60 nuclear plants were still operating 98 reactors in the United States in 2018, supplying 20% of the country's energy, more than 100 orders for new nuclear plants were canceled after the Three Mile Island accident, and only two new nuclear plants were under construction as of 2017. Jesse Jackson. He could have been a professional athlete, but became a preacher instead, and as a result, became known as the President of Black America. Jesse Jackson was born in October 1941, the illegitimate son of a South Carolina cotton buyer who ignored Jackson for much of his early life. After a career as an all-state football player in high school, Jackson passed up a pro baseball contract and went to college instead. He also became active in the civil rights movement and was with Martin Luther King Jr. when King was assassinated in Memphis in 1968. In that same year, Jackson was ordained a Baptist minister. Basing his work in Chicago, Jackson founded a program in 1971 called Operation Push, People United to Save Humanity. The program was designed to address problems facing inner-city youth. In 1984, he formed the National Rainbow Coalition, the aim of which was to bring together members of all races to address common goals. Jackson also ran for president in 1984 and 1988, generating enough support to become a major player in National Democratic Party politics. He has also been something of a diplomat without a portfolio, negotiating the release of hostages in Syria, Cuba, and Iraq. In 2002, it was revealed that Jackson had had an affair with a staff member and fathered a daughter with her in 1999. The revelation resulted in Jackson temporarily withdrawing from public life, and in late 2017, he announced he had Parkinson's disease. But he continued in his role as an inspirational, if sometimes divisive, advocate for human rights. Befriending the enemy. On the foreign front, Carter had mixed results. He negotiated treaties to gradually transfer the Panama Canal territory to Panama. He reached an agreement with the Soviet Union to restrict the development of nuclear arms, and he furthered the restoration of relations with Communist China that Richard Nixon had started. Carter's biggest triumph was in engineering a historic peace agreement between Israel and Egypt, which had been at each other's throats since Israel's birth in 1948. At Camp David, the presidential retreat in Maryland, Carter brokered a deal in 1978 with Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin and Egyptian President Anwar Sadat. Sadat and Begin got the Nobel Peace Prize for their efforts. Carter got nothing but trouble in the form of multiple disasters involving Iran. the United States had backed the Shah of Iran since 1953, when the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, helped him regain power in that country. When the Shah was thrown out again in 1979 and replaced with a Muslim religious leader named the Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the United States allowed the Shah to receive medical treatment in America. That angered Iranian mobs, which invaded the U.S. Embassy in the Iranian capital of Tehran on November 4, 1979. The mobs held the occupants of the embassy hostage. Some hostages were allowed to leave, but 52 were kept as prisoners. In April 1980, Carter ordered a team of Marine commandos to Iran on a rescue mission. Because of a series of screw-ups and accidents involving the rescue aircraft, 8 commandos were killed before the actual rescue even began, and the mission was called off. Finally, after the Shah died in July, negotiations for the hostages' release began. They ended with the hostages being freed on January 20, 1981, after 444 days in captivity. The day the hostages were freed was, coincidentally, the last day of Carter's presidency. There's a first time for everything. If you told someone in 1951 that Ronald Reagan would someday be president of the United States, he would have suggested you check into a rest home for the politically delusional. After all, the veteran actor had just starred in Bedtime for Bonzo, in which his co-star was a chimpanzee. That qualified him for Congress, certainly, but hardly the White House. In addition to being the first president to have starred in a movie with an ape, Reagan was also the first president to have been divorced and, at the age of 69, the oldest president when he took office. Reagan was born in Illinois in 1911 and, after college, became a sportscaster in Iowa. In 1937, a screen test led to Hollywood, and Reagan became a second-tier star, first in movies and then on TV. His taste for politics grew from serving 2 terms as president of the Screen Actors Guild, and as his politics became increasingly conservative, he found himself a favorite of the Republican Party's right wing. He ran for governor of California in 1966, defeating incumbent Pat Brown, and served 2 terms. As governor, Reagan demonstrated 2 strengths that served him well: a pragmatic streak that allowed him to compromise, and the willingness to consider the advice of others. In 1976, he came in a strong second for the GOP presidential nomination, and then, in 1980, he swept both the nomination and the presidency over the unpopular Carter. His 2 greatest campaign assets turned out to be a single question. Ask yourself, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And on not being Jimmy Carter. As president, Reagan was essentially a cheerleader for a vision of America that counted on everyone trying not to be too different from one another and not relying on the federal government to do much. He seemed to have an inexhaustible supply of both good and bad luck. He bounced back from being shot and seriously wounded after giving a speech at a Washington hotel in 1981, and in 1985, he won a bout with cancer. Despite his health problems, he managed an easy re-election victory in 1984 over Democrat Walter Mondale, who had been vice president under Jimmy Carter. Reagan greeted political setbacks with boundless good cheer and a joke or two. And no matter what else happened, Reagan's personal popularity stayed high, so much so that he became known as the Teflon President. Like the nonstick coating used on pots and pans, nothing seemed to stick to him. But his nice guy persona didn't mean he was wishy-washy. When the country's air traffic controllers ignored federal law and went on strike in 1981, Reagan promptly fired all 11,400 of them and refused to rehire them after the strike ended. Geraldine Ferraro. She was a self-made woman who made a pioneering mark in America's democratic process, even though she came from a New York borough with a most undemocratic name, Queens. Ferraro was born in 1935, the daughter of an Italian immigrant. After graduating college, Ferraro became an elementary school teacher while going to law school at night. After graduating law school, she married and for the next 13 years was a mother and housewife. In 1974, she joined the Queens District Attorney's Office, and in 1978, she was elected to Congress. As a congresswoman, Ferraro became an advocate for women's issues, particularly in providing greater job training opportunities and in ending gender discrimination in pension plans. In 1984, she was picked by Democratic presidential candidate Walter Mondale to be his running mate, making her the first woman to be part of the ticket for either of the two major U.S. political parties, as well as the first Italian-American. Mondale and Ferraro were clobbered in the election. It didn't help that a stink arose over allegations Ferraro's husband had done business with organized crime figures. Ferraro subsequently ran unsuccessfully for the U.S. Senate, hosted a TV political talk show, wrote three books, and became a business consultant. She died in 2011. "We've come a long way since 84," she said in a 1999 interview. "That election really paved the way for women, and not just in politics." Buying into the Reagan Revolution. One of the fastest-growing portions of America's population during the 1980s didn't have a clue what Reagan was talking about when he laid out his vision of the country, and probably wouldn't have liked it had they understood. They were immigrants from countries like Mexico, Cuba, Haiti, and Vietnam, who came to the United States by the tens of thousands during the 1980s. Many of them were counting on some form of government assistance to get started in their new lives in the new land. But the people who had voted for Reagan knew exactly what he was talking about. Many of them were part of the Sun Belt, the fast-growing states of the Southeast, Southwest, and West. As the region's population grew, so did its representation in Congress and its political clout. The area became so powerful that every president elected between 1964 and 2008 was from a southern or western state. In the West, in particular, Reagan's call for less government was in perfect harmony with the Sagebrush Rebellion. The rebellion, which was mostly rhetorical, was a reaction to land use and environmental regulations made in faraway Washington that were considered a threat to development of urban areas and resource-based industries, such as timber and mining. Reagan was the beneficiary of the growth in the Sun Belt's clout. Remember, Reagan also benefited from a revival in Christian evangelicalism that married itself to conservative politics in the late 1970s and 1980s. Conservative evangelicals, those who said they had been born again through a direct personal experience with Jesus Christ, and who were often referred to in a political sense as the Christian right, were alarmed at what they saw as the country's moral laxity in the 1960s and early 1970s. America's real problems, they argued, could be traced to feminism, abortion, rising divorce rates, and homosexuality. Groups like the Moral Majority, led by a Virginia-based TV evangelist named Jerry Falwell, became powerful political forces in terms of raising money and mobilizing mass support, or opposition, for legislation and political candidates. Another religious right leader, Marion G. Pat Robertson, founded the Christian Coalition and twice ran for president himself. Finally, Reagan was supported by followers of a more secular cause, tax cutting. The high inflation of the 1970s caused many people's income and property values to rise, and also pushed them into higher tax brackets that ate up much of the increases. That naturally fueled taxpayers' anger. In California, a cranky political gadfly named Howard Jarvis successfully pushed through an initiative that dramatically cut property taxes and required state and local governments to drastically shift their way of financing government operations. The success of Proposition 13 led to similar efforts in other states. It also helped Reagan push through his own brand of tax cutting. Jim Baker. He once spent $100 on cinnamon rolls so his hotel room would smell nice, which was okay because he was doing God's work and had plenty of cash to spare. Jim Baker was born in 1940 and grew up in a small town in Michigan. After high school, he attended a Bible college and became a minister. In the early 1970s, Baker began a Christian puppet show on a local TV station in Virginia. He developed a TV ministry that became known as the PTL Club, which to followers stood for Praise the Lord, and to critics stood for Pass the Loot. There was plenty of that. With contributions from hundreds of thousands of his followers, Baker and his wife Tammy Faye, who wore what seemed to be pounds of makeup and wept at the drop of a psalm, built Heritage USA, a 2,300-acre Christian-themed resort, water park, and entertainment complex in South Carolina. In 1988, however, it was revealed that PTL had paid $265,000 to a former secretary named Jessica Hahn to keep her quiet about a sexual encounter she had had with Baker 8 years before. The revelation was only one of many that followed over the next year. In 1989, Baker was convicted of bilking more than 100,000 people of $158 million. He served 5 years in federal prison, and the scandal helped put the brakes on the momentum of the Christian right. After prison, Baker resumed his television preaching career, contending that the end of the world was near, and advertising buckets of freeze-dried food for those who survived. Paying for Reaganomics. Reagan figured that if you cut taxes on companies and the very wealthy and reduced regulations on business, they would invest more, the economy would expand, and everyone would benefit. This approach, based heavily on the views of the Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman, a Reagan advisor, required cutting government services because there would be less tax revenue to pay for them. That would most affect Americans on the bottom of the economic ladder. But the benefits would eventually trickle down from those on the top of the ladder to those on the bottom, at least in theory. So, early in his administration, Reagan pushed through a package of massive tax cuts, and the economy got better. Unemployment dropped from 11% in 1982 to about 8% in 1983. Inflation dropped below 5%, and the gross national product rose. Remember, while Reaganistas were quick to point to the president's policies as a great deal, critics pointed in a different direction. Although Reagan had cut taxes, he and Congress had failed to cut government spending. In fact, they greatly increased spending, particularly on military programs. Because the government was spending far more than it was taking in, the national debt rose from about $900 billion in 1980 to a staggering $3 trillion in 1990. Moreover, most of the benefits of Reagan's trickle-down approach failed to trickle, priming the pump for another economic downturn after he left office. Dealing with foreign affairs. As a true conservative, Reagan didn't much care for the Soviet Union or communists in general. He heated up the Cold War by, among other things, referring to the Soviets as amoral and irreligious. Toward the end of his second term, however, Reagan's anti-Soviet feelings began to soften, particularly after a moderate named Mikhail Gorbachev became Soviet leader. The Challenger tragedy. It was cold and windy at Cape Canaveral the morning of January 28, 1986, but U.S. space program officials were determined to go ahead with the launch of the Space Shuttle Challenger. After all, the Challenger had already made 9 successful trips into space, and the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, had run 24 space shuttle missions without a major problem. At 11:38 a.m., Eastern Daylight Time, NASA launched its 25th mission. At 11:40, as thousands of spectators watched in horror at the launch site, and millions more watched on TV, the shuttle exploded shortly after lifting off. All 7 of the crew members were killed, including a Concord, New Hampshire schoolteacher named Krista McAuliffe, who was along for the ride as a way of increasing children's interest in the space program. The cause of the explosion was later traced to a flaw in the rocket's booster system and led to a complete reevaluation of the shuttle and an examination of more than 1,000 of its parts. More than 2 years passed before the shuttle program was allowed to resume, and 17 years passed before the next